This is the second episode in a two-part series. Please listen to part one before continuing with this episode. It discusses crime scenes, homicide, and violence. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. Last episode, we began the story of Grace Chin, mother, teacher, and well-loved friend who was murdered in 2014 at the Austin Mall where her business, Grace Language and Cultural Institute, had opened just a year before. She was killed in the early afternoon on February 19th. Her body was discovered in a private area of the strip mall, accessible only to tenants, and on a busy weekday. The other business owners and the city of Austin were in shock. According to the Austin American-Statesman, there was no clear motive apparent in Grace's murder. Local leaders in the Asian American community wondered if a hate crime was possible. Less than a month earlier, a Chinese American family, the Suns, had been murdered in their Houston area home. Their case was still open in February of 2014, with no motives or leads announced. Within a week of Grace's death, there would be a meeting between Austin PD and community leaders and concerned citizens to discuss the case and the possibility of a hate crime. But first, there would be a vigil for Grace, and later, a memorial service. Her 21-year-old son, Jackie, rushed home from California, where he'd been attending college. Grace, a native of China, moved to the Austin area in 2009 with Jackie, who was then in high school, and with her second husband, Robert. She and Jackie had immigrated to the U.S. in 2007 to join Robert in New York State. According to what Jackie had told us, he and his mother had struggled in New York, but Grace had found a community in Austin and had become a fixture in it. She participated in Chinese dance performances and celebrations, sat on a number of boards, and connected with community leaders like Amy Wong Mok. Amy, who's director of Austin's Asian American Cultural Center and the president of the Asian American Community Partnership in the city, only met Grace once in life to discuss the opening of Grace's language school. But since Grace's murder in 2014, Amy has spoken to numerous news outlets, year after year, about the case. She's gotten to know a lot about Grace through those who loved her, and so Amy keeps calling APD each year and speaking with every reporter who asks her, and will, until Grace's case is finally solved. Back in 2014, Amy's name appeared in articles within the first few days, as she was asked to speak in her role as a community leader. She asked the question many in Austin had, why Grace? In a later interview with TV channel KVU, Amy Wong Mok stated the feeling very succinctly, quote, "Nobody spoke anything negative about her. She was such a nice person." That fact, and the lack of a clear motive, such as robbery, would leave others confused as well. The Galleria Oaks, the mall where Grace's language school was located, was in an area with plenty of other homes and businesses. According to a report from KXAN, residents in the neighborhood just behind the shopping center, they were concerned and left wondering what, if anything, the police had discovered. And in the week after Grace's death, they spoke with local reporters. One resident, Terry Carlman, explained, quote, "We were all very curious to know how it happened and what the police knew about it. We haven't heard anything really. It's just right up there, a few blocks." Another resident, Aaron Oliver, added, quote, "It would be nice to know if this was random or if they think it wasn't random. If they had a suspect, it would be nice to know." But the person feeling the most shock and confusion was, of course, Jackie, Grace's son. He'd just seen his mother a few days before her death when she'd come to California to visit him at school. They discussed plans for her new courses at the Grace Language and Cultural Institute, but also some worries she'd been having. According to Jackie, Grace was concerned about the sustainability of the school and also needed some extra help with running it. After some negotiations with his mother, who didn't want him to sacrifice any time he could spend on his education, Jackie convinced her to let him take the next semester off and return home to work with her for a while. That was one problem solved, but there was something else that she brought up during the trip. As far as Jackie knows, he's the only person that she ever discussed this with, so we can't verify the information beyond his recollection. As we told you last episode, Jackie claims that, on that final visit to California, Grace asked him a question.
She asked me how would I feel if she wanted to divorce my stepdad. I think that was the exact question that she asked me, like, how would I feel? And then my answer was, as long as it's what's best for her. If she decides the thing doesn't work out between the two of them, I would feel totally fine. Don't worry about me. Make your decision, and then if this is what you want, then go for it. Don't worry about what I think, because I'll be okay, because I'm not a kid anymore.
How far Grace would have pursued that idea, or her precise reasons for seeking a divorce, if that is indeed what she ultimately planned to do, we don't know. She died soon after her return to Austin, before she could really discuss her plans with Jackie again. If she had taken any legal steps, that information has not been publicly disclosed, and we couldn't locate anything in the court databases. Jackie isn't aware of her retaining a lawyer or moving forward with any kind of specific action, just that she was considering a divorce. Her visit was still fresh in Jackie's mind when he received that earth-shattering phone call that something had happened to Grace at Galleria Oaks. And he had trouble processing that information. After all, he'd just seen her, and she'd been the same mother he'd always known. Kind, energetic, full of excitement about her school. When he got the phone call telling him that his mother had died, he was shocked. Of course he was shocked. But he had trouble even comprehending, at first, that she could have died by violence.
I got a phone call from my ex-girlfriend from high school. She was helping out at my mom's school as a part-time assistant. So I was in class in San Francisco. And then in the middle of the break, I got a phone call from her. And I think she told me something happened to my mom. I think that's her exact word. Something happened to your mom. The first thing I can think of is maybe she was in a car accident, right? She was in the hospital. That was the first thing that came to my mind when I received the phone call. I didn't expect a murder case, right? I thought maybe a car accident, that she was deeply injured and then she was in the hospital. That was the first thing. And then after that, there wasn't much going on because I just couldn't believe that's true because she just left from San Fran a few days ago. And then just like 2 days after, I got a phone call that she's gone. What I remember was I was just crying on a cab on my way to the San Francisco airport. And then the driver was trying to calm me down. And I asked him to tell me that my mom will be okay. And then he did so. Once I arrived at the airport, I just went straight to the counter and then get the ticket back to home.
Do you remember who picked you up from the airport?
No, I just took a cab to the Austin Police Department. No one picked me up.
When you went to the police station, were you by yourself or did anyone meet you?
My stepdad and my ex-girlfriend were there.
Is that when you found out the details, the specifics?
I think, yeah, they did. Not as specific as later, but I did find out what kind of happened to her at the police department. We talked to Detective Scanlon. That was the detective who was responsible for the case. And then he later retired. But he was the one that explained to me what happened.
Do you remember first contacting your family, your biological father, or your mom's parents?
Yeah, I think that's like the most difficult part of this. I wouldn't let my stepdad to call them. I think a part of me just didn't trust him to deliver the message. I insist that I call them myself. Yeah, it was pretty tough. So I called my aunt first. My uncle picked up the phone call. Well, basically, I told him what happened. It was hard, but I found a way to let him know what happened to mom. And then I let him kind of figure out how to let my aunt know. It was just difficult. I remember I was just had my knee on the ground and just crying outside the house. I didn't want to do it in front of my stepdad. I feel like I wanted to have like a personal space to make the phone call. It was pretty tough. And then after I told my aunt and my uncle, and then I called my dad. I think when I called him, he already received the phone call from my aunt. She already told my dad, and then he kind of had that coming before I called him. And then we didn't tell my grandparents on that day. We wanted to have family next to my grandparents when they found out what happened.
In China, Jackie's aunt and father traveled cross-country to see his grandparents and tell them the news in person. Because of their age, the shock was a real concern.
Yeah, I just thought it would be better to let my dad and my aunt know first, and then they will make the best decision and the best arrangement to accompany my grandparents and let them know what happened. I'm glad I made that decision to call them myself. Yeah, even though it was painful to call, I think it was the right call for me to do that.
It also reminds me when you talked about when you were younger, your mom was very carefully trying to consider how to communicate with you in a way that was going to not traumatize you.
Maybe I got that from her too. They always tell me that sometimes I care about others' feelings over myself. Maybe I got that from her as well. Yeah, it's definitely her influence on me. I will try to make the best decision as possible, that including how to contact my grandparents, my aunt, and you know, how to deal with the media, and then how to talk to the police. I think that was like the first thing. I didn't really think of what happened now since my family is gone and I'm all alone in the U.S. What I didn't do is I wish I sent out the information online, you know, spread out the word. That's one thing that I wish I could have done. Because I since the incident, I never post anything about her passing on my personal social media. Even to today, I only have like a few close friends who know what happened. I'm not sure why. Maybe like a part of me didn't want to spread the negativity on the internet, and a part of me was afraid to let people know that I just lost my mother.
As Jackie informed his relatives and began answering APD's questions, local leader Amy Wong Mok, who you've heard from throughout these episodes, had sprung into action. Though she'd only met Grace in person once, Amy knew her well through reputation and was concerned for Jackie and for the larger community. There had been no word as to a possible motive for Grace's murder, and with the shooting of the Sun family in the Houston suburb, many were worried about the possibility of a series of racially motivated crimes. And if that wasn't the case, well, the concern was equally there to find Grace's killer and bring that person or persons to justice.
You know, Northwest Austin is supposed to be a pretty safe environment, and so we were shocked. And then the community started getting organized and getting a candle vigil for her, and I felt like we need to have the police chief, you know, to come in and visit with us, you know, and really give us the community some information. And so I basically, together with other people, organized a town hall meeting with Chief Acevedo, and he came and at our Asian American Cultural Center, and it was packed. It was not usual for so many people show up, you know, at a town hall meeting with the chief police. So it was packed and, you know, standing room only. And then Jackie came. I introduced him to Chief Acevedo. And the chief just lost his mother And so he understood, you know, how difficult it must be for Jackie. And then he and several his assistant chief, the lieutenant, it was well attended of the police staff. He told us that at our town hall meeting that they have gathered some evidence or DNA. It at least gave me the impression that they already have somebody in mind, that the case will be resolved soon.
According to KXAN News, quote, Acevedo assured everyone Chen's death was an isolated incident and that the Asian community was not a target. KXAN reported that during the town hall that Amy just mentioned, then-Chief Acevedo said, quote, You can see this is a community that stands with the police. So a word to the wise. Don't come to Austin to commit murder, because we're not giving up. Amy, Jackie, and Dan Dan Joe, Grace's best friend, were in attendance. Despite assurances, Amy said, quote, There's a lot of collective fear, a lot of collective trauma, because if it could happen to her, it could happen to us. Dan Dan told KXAN, quote, I'm hopeful this will not become a cold case. It will stay hot, and this will be solved. The chief explained that it would take weeks to more fully process the crime scene, but that, per KXAN, he was hopeful forensic evidence discovered there might lead to an arrest. But that arrest didn't come in 2014. There was never any tie to the son's case announced. As far as we've been able to discover, their murders remain unsolved, with no leads or persons of interest publicly identified. A year after Grace's murder, in 2015, KXAN ran an update on her case. They spoke with Sergeant Brian Miller of APD, who indicated that significant work had been done on Grace's homicide case. He showed reporters portions of her file, which contained, quote, hours of interviews, a timeline of the case, and photos of the crime scene. Sergeant Miller told KXAN, quote, It's by far not a cold case. It's something we look at almost daily. There is evidence available, but it hasn't been matched up to anybody, so that's kind of what we're working on right now. According to KXAN, Austin police confirmed that DNA had been recovered as well. One factor underlined in this article is the locked door aspect of this case. Previous news articles touched on the scene of the crime, the tenants-only bathroom, but this 2015 KXAN report explicitly points out the fact that the door to the bathroom could only be opened by a key. And what's more, the article indicates the bathroom was locked when Grace's body was discovered. We haven't seen any information regarding whether Grace's key was found at the scene of the crime. However, more news regarding Grace's life, though not her death necessarily, was released by Austin media in the years following her murder. According to an Austin American Statesman article, Robert, Grace's husband, was faced with legal trouble unrelated to her death. Quote, About a year after Chen died, Loy was arrested in connection with a high-dollar art theft. He was sentenced to a 2-month stint in federal prison for interstate sale of stolen property. Apparently, this case dated back to the family's time in New York. Per the Statesman, Robert was employed for 8 years with an art company in New York State, and upon his move to Texas, he, quote, left the job with about $100,000 in paintings, some of which he sold on eBay through Grace Fine Art in Austin, end quote. And we want to stress here, there are no news sources that implicate Grace Chen or indicate that she had any knowledge that this artwork was stolen, something that Jackie also reiterated for us. The Statesman reported that Robert began his sentence for this crime on July 6, 2016, and was released on September 2, 2016. He was ordered to, quote, serve 3 years on supervised release and pay $84,132.25 in restitution. The Statesman adds one more detail that we were not aware of until we began research for this case. Quote, Public records show that he petitioned a judge to travel to China to get married shortly after his release, but that the request was denied. In 2017, When the Austin Statesman reported those facts, Grace's homicide case was under the direction of Detective Jay Swan. He gave News Channel KVIEW an update on the case, and he was very direct as to his focus. Per KVIEW, Detective Swan said, quote, "I've done a lot of work in the last 3 months, specifically on this case, and I believe it's a good case that we can bring to a resolution." KVIEW then reported that Swan, quote, "said police are looking at Grace Chin's husband and Jackie's stepfather." In that same interview, Detective Swan added that, quote, "he's a person of interest in this investigation, and he has not been cleared." During our research, we didn't find any more news articles that mentioned why exactly Detective Swan considered Grace's husband to be a person of interest. Grace's friends and family hoped to hear more news on the case. But despite the 2017 update regarding hopeful leads, which was reported on by both KVIEW and the Austin American Statesman, anniversaries continued to come and go, marking the case as open and unresolved. Detective Jay Swan has since retired, and in future updates, specifically in 2020, Austin police declined to name a person of interest. Now, in 2021, Detective David Ruzick is in charge of Grace's case. As a detective in the cold case unit, he works both cold cases and missing persons investigations. We had a chance to speak with him about Grace's case and his approach to cold case work. When were you assigned to Grace's case?
I was assigned as the lead, I'd say, approximately 1.5 to 2 years ago.
And when you take on a new cold case, what's your approach?
So typically, you know, I'll thoroughly review the offense report. I'll look at statements. I'll take a look at the full inventory of all the evidence that we have stored. I'll look at any other like ancillary documents. We'll try to summarize like the important aspects of the documents. They're normally pretty vast amount of information, so I'll try to summarize it to make it more manageable. And I'll also, as far as like, you know, doing re-interviews, it's really kind of case dependent. I'll typically look at the individual's, you know, relationship to the case. I'll look at the number of times that they were previously interviewed, because typically cold cases will go through several iterations of lead investigators. For example, Grace's case, I'm the fourth lead investigator. So a lot of the interviews have been done, and they've been done on multiple occasions. And I'll take that into consideration and you know, kind of decide on the potential that the individual may have more information. I'll say that's pretty much my normal process of getting started on a new cold case.
We know that when you became lead investigator on Grace's case, you told local reporters that you had no specific person of interest. Does that have something to do with the way that you personally handle cold cases?
Yeah, I'm aware in this case, you know, specifically that prior investigators have commented about certain individuals being persons of interest in the case. I'd say, in my personal experience, it varies from investigator to investigator. It's, you know, kind of very circumstance dependent when it's appropriate to publicly name individuals as persons of interest. I'd say in my approach or my style and knowledge of the case, I don't believe it currently adds any value to Grace's investigation to name any specific individuals at this point. Essentially, if an individual had the means, motive, opportunity, then that's someone that's going to remain on my radar until facts or evidence essentially dictate otherwise. So I typically like to just keep a very broad view of the overall investigation.
We know that Grace's death occurred in a relatively tight time frame on a weekday in the afternoon. And while the scene itself was in a private area, the larger setting was public, with potentially dozens of people in the vicinity where the crime occurred. We know that APD questioned many of the business owners from the Galleria, but are there shoppers who might have been there that could be helpful to APD?
Yeah, so the initial, 911 call to police came in, roughly 3:30 in the afternoon. It was a Wednesday, February 19th, 2014. So, roughly over 7 years ago. The overall setting, like you mentioned, was it's a large two-story business complex. Most of those businesses were more like specialty type businesses, such as just for example, optometrist or a chiropractor, or in Grace's case, she ran a Chinese language and art school. So there wasn't necessarily a constant flow of foot traffic throughout the complex as far as customers. Investigators early on canvassed the business complex and surrounding area, very thoroughly. They spoke to the, nearby employees, business owners, but at that point, really no actionable information was garnered early on through those interviews. And to my knowledge, all the employees of the complex were identified and interviewed, but certainly if there are any individuals that were in the Gallery Oaks, complex shopping or business complex on that day that haven't spoken to police about information they may have that could be pertinent to the investigation, we'd certainly be interested in talking to anyone that was there or may have pertinent information.
One important thing that Detective Ruzick's comments here clarify is that with the kind of businesses in the complex, many of which were appointment-based or open for sessions or classes or for blocks of time during the day versus continuously, there may have been fewer possible witnesses than an average shopping center could have produced. Now that you've been working on Grace's case for some time, are there any developments you can share? Have you developed any new leads or information that could potentially help resolve her case?
Grace's case, unfortunate reality is that it's not a case where I'd anticipate an arrest is imminent. I previously mentioned I'm the fourth investigator on this case, so the currently available facts and evidence have been reviewed by multiple individuals or investigators. I'd say personally my primary approach to this case has been more to focus on forensics and try to take advantage of the latest advancements in that in forensics. So I've been working with, since I've been assigned the case, I've been working with our staff, DNA scientists and analysts, to develop and try to implement a forensic testing strategy with this case. We went through a series of testing last year, and I've been, continually in contact with them, and we sat down a month or so ago and we've come up with, additional items that we're going to want to take a look at. And we're already working with a private lab. The testing is somewhat time consuming. So we're getting that process for additional testing, continuing. It's a continuing process.
What are the biggest difficulties you face when you're working cold cases? We often cover cases that are 20, 30, even 40 years old, but do more recent cold cases like Grace's face some of the same challenges as their much older counterparts?
I currently have cases spread across the spectrum. My current oldest case is about 40 years old, and my newest is around 3 years old. I'd say, in my experience, there are some notable differences among cases as it relates to the age of the case. For example, in my older cases, I've run into issues, one of the more notable examples, run into issues where law enforcement representatives or even witnesses being of such advanced age that they're difficult to communicate with, or even in some cases, they're deceased. And also, obviously, memories tend to fade over time. So the newer the case, typically, the more detailed the information is that they can recollect regarding a case. And also, there's always potential for, evidence, physical evidence degradation to a certain extent. It's always sometimes a concern. Obviously, we take our mitigation efforts when it comes to storage and stuff like that. But just another aspect, you know, as far as Grace's case being around, you know, just over 7 years old, it kind of falls, you know, in the middle of that spectrum. 7 years, you know, memories are starting to kind of, you know, fade some, and, you know, it's just where we're the point that we are, you know, in the investigation. So that, you know, it's one of the reasons I'm personally kind of trying to rely, you know, a lot on forensic evidence also.
As a detective, how do you balance wanting to share information and keep a family informed with the need to hold information back in order to protect a case? And when I say protect a case, I mean information that may help identify a perpetrator.
You know, as law enforcement, it really is a balancing act trying to uphold the integrity of a case, at the same time reinforcing the family's confidence that the investigation is continuing forward and it's progressing. Oftentimes, for example, one of the primary reasons for confidentiality is that making certain facts public can degrade the investigatory value of that information. You know, example being, you know, if a potential suspect were developed and interviewed, or if a tipster comes forward, you know, obviously that the information is going to be more valuable legally or more easily identifiable in the importance of that information if it's known only within the controlled law enforcement circles.
Jackie has spent a lot of time thinking about the possible answers in his mother's case. The following interview clip includes some recollections that are his perspective and don't necessarily reflect what his stepfather Robert may or may not have been feeling at the time. As we mentioned, we were unable to reach him for comment.
So on the day of my arrival, when I arrived to the police department, to be honest, I didn't have much feeling about or suspicion regarding the case. Because I just got there and I just learned really basic description of what happened. So I didn't really know anything. I didn't feel anything besides sorrow. But as time progressed, I would say I would love to hear my stepdad's point of view. That would be something I would be really interested in, from Robert to be specific. The reason why is after mom's incident, even though I feel a lot of support from friends, the community members, from my mom's friends, I don't recall that much support from his end. I could be biased, but who knows. How I felt was he cared a lot about how we handle the funds, right? Maybe I have a deeper connection to my mom than him. One thing I remember is I tried to spend as much I can for my mom's coffin, because we were approached by one of the ladies. She was responsible for the funeral. So there's like different kind of choices, right? You can get the wood one or paper one, I think. Different kind of choices of coffin. I was trying to get the best that I can get for her. We chose like a basket one because I felt that it's more natural and then it will be more comfortable for her to stay in. But my stepdad, he was pretty concerned about the budget. Like, I forgot how much it was, but for example, there's like a cheaper one that's 300, right? And then the basket one may cost 600 or whatever. It will be cost more. And I recall him suggesting that maybe we can go for the cheaper one, you know, the more affordable one. That's one thing. To me, it's, I just didn't really accept it, you know. I would pay for it like $10,000 if I had the money. And the other thing is, as time progressed, I still kept in touch with all the detectives and I still talk to them. And sometimes I got curious and asked them if Robert have ever contacted them for information about the case. The answer is negative, right? He never called them regarding the case. I just didn't understand, you know. Even though they might have conflict, they might have argument, they were married for a few years. So in my opinion, as a human being, I would call and at least like once a year to know how things are going at least. But he didn't, giving my mom talk to me about divorcing when she was in San Francisco, and their relationship is not the best. With everything together, to me, I would just need some answer from Robert, right? I would just like, what are you thinking? Why haven't you contacted the police after all these years? No, does he feel anything? Those are the questions I would ask him.
Cold cases need leads and tips. Often they are essential to a resolution, and even that can depend on advocacy. If you listen to our interview with Renetta DeBose, you know what a grind that can be for a family, year after year. And in Jackie's situation, he's hundreds of miles removed from his mother's case. With Jackie in California, Amy Wong Mok has taken on the responsibility of making sure Grace's case remains a focus for Austin PD and for Austin media.
Amy will contact local media, and she will also contact the police department from time to time and then ask them about the progress and then hopefully schedule an interview. For that, I'm grateful for Amy and for what she did, because it's also one part of my responsibility, in my opinion, to contact the media. I did contact the police and I stayed in touch with the detective, but I didn't feel comfortable, or I just didn't have the courage to contact the media to do report on the case. But also I know it's essential to keep the case alive, and I appreciate that Amy has done that for me, and I have so many opportunities to share the story with the media. I can talk to them. If Amy didn't do that, if Amy hadn't done all those phone calls, I think we won't be getting that much exposure to the case.
For Amy's part, she also feels a responsibility to carry information back to the community center, where, each year, people ask about Grace, hoping her case has seen movement.
They always, different channel will have a reporting, you know, around that time. Because it's around Valentine's Day, you know, in February. Sort of make it, you know, quite relevant, because that is when we celebrate our Lunar New Year, and I usually have a community event at the center, and the people who attended, you know, the event will ask, you know, every year, well, do you know anything about the murder case of Grace Chen, and where's the progress now? You know, so I always get asked, you know, at our Lunar New Year celebration, and it is really very upsetting that I have nothing to report back to them, you know. And so you can imagine that after so many years, that is still, you know, not being solved. We were so afraid that the murder of Grace Chen will become a cold case. And sure enough, you know, it's a cold case now. So that's why every year I made a point to contact the police department to inquire about the progress that has been made on this murder case, because this is our promise to stand with Jackie to get to the bottom of it, to have this resolved. I feel like we need to fulfill our promise. You know, Jackie, we fell for him because he is so alone. He lost a mother whom he can talk about his challenge, his triumph, and his career path, his relationships, and maybe his marriage and raising his children. And he lost someone so dear to him to guide him through his transition, you know, from a teenager to an adult. You know, I think he was still in school when it happened, and he lost the only family member that he had in a new country, has to adjust to the language, to the culture, it is tough. You know, it is tough to any immigrant, but especially tough when you lost your support, you know, especially from your mother. And he's like our son now, you know, the son of our community. And this is what we do, you know, this is in our cultural upbringing, that all children are our children. We don't want him to feel alone. We actually assure him all the time, and especially every year, you know, when we ask for the progress report from Austin Police Department, we always copy him in our email, making sure that we will not forget our promise to him.
Jackie told us about what the last 7 years have been like, growing up without Grace into an adult that she would have been proud to see.
In the summer of 2014, I did travel back to China. I went back to visit my grandparents, and also I brought her ashes back to China, back to her hometown, so we can have like a funeral. And then after that, I did visit a few places. My dad wanted me to go. Maybe he thought that will help me to distract me from the sorrow. I think it did. There are places that I've never been before, and then I wish she could have been there visiting me, because when I was in elementary school, when we were still in China, my mom would like to take me to a different city in China to explore the local environment, to see more different people and different culture. She did try to do that for me when we were in China. I wish I could have done the same for her in China and also in the U.S. I bought my car in 2014 after she passed away. My dad bought it for me. I didn't buy it. My dad bought it for me. It would be easier for me to travel in San Francisco. I wish I had that when she was living in San Francisco earlier, before she passed away, so I can take her to a different city. We don't have to take Muni. That's the bus system. Maybe we can go to Napa and try out the wine. And maybe we can go to Los Angeles and then Redwood National Park. I know she would love that, because she loves the nature and all the trees and the air. I wish she was there during my graduation ceremony. I brought my dog from Austin to San Francisco. Her dog, the dachshund. The dog was with me on the day of the graduation. I have the studio. I have the income, right? With income, I would be able to buy her a nice thing. Maybe take her to different places. And I would love to have her meet my girlfriend. And now it's my wife. Yeah, I would love to have my wife meet my mom as well. And we are planning to get our own house this year. It would be nice if she's still around. Maybe she can go to the house tour with us. I think the biggest regret, not regret, but the biggest thing that I wish is seeing me getting married, and also for me getting a somehow stable job, you know, having the income, will be able to pay my bills, and also have like real conversation with her after I'm all grown up. Yeah, those are the things that I would wish that she could be here. I also want her to know that the dog is doing okay. His name is Fatty, and he's 13 years old, and we got him, I think, the year when we moved to the U.S. in New York. So he's been with us for like forever now. And he was like the little baby of my mom. And I want her to know that Fatty's okay, and then I'm okay. And I would like to have Sushi, my wife, meet her. Those are the things I would think of.
One positive change in Jackie's life, even as he waits for word from Austin police and continues to live without Grace, is the strong relationship he's built with his biological father. After Grace's death, they've worked to communicate more often and strengthen their bond, even separated by 16 hours time difference and visits that are much less frequent than they'd like.
I think how I actually feel that I got his support as a father after mom's incident. So we got closer after I grew up, and after I moved out and traveled to the United States. We got closer than before, because I think as I grow, I tend to understand more, and I feel more comfortable to talk to him and spend time with him. After mom died, my dad did his best to support me and support my grandparents, and we're grateful about what he did. And also, we're thankful that he was able to help us at that time, because there are a lot of financial issues back then in 2014. I feel like even though mom's gone, I still have him beside me, and I don't have to feel afraid, because I know whatever happens, he will still be able to take care of my grandparents and also take care of me. And for that, I'm very thankful for my dad. Yeah, and we will still have a close contact nowadays. We talk at least every month, like we chat or through WeChat on a daily basis.
And is he in Guangzhou?
Yeah, he's in Guangzhou right now with his family. I have a half-sister and half-brother, and we're pretty close. Given the circumstances, I would say we're pretty close. But we're not as close as we're staying with each other every day, you know, that kind of close. But yeah, we play with each other, and I talk to them. They're happy to see me when I return. And my dad's wife, she's very friendly as well. They're a nice family.
If you have any information regarding the unsolved murder of Xiaojia Grace Chen, please contact the Austin Police Department's Cold Case Unit at 512-974-5250. You can also submit information to the unit's email address at apdcoldcasemissingpersons@austintexas.gov. There'll be a link in our show notes. Capital Area Crime Stoppers offers rewards of up to $1,000. Their number is 512-472-8477. If you know of a case that should be covered on the Fall Line, there's a link to our case submission form in the show notes. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to fund the Millbrook Twins billboard and to raise a therapy fund for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our patrons helps us continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added video live streams, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just $1. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kim Fritz, and Kiana Burgess. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Our monthly donation is going to Private Investigations for the Missing. Please join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the services of PIs.